Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Melanie Mitchell. She is the Davis Professor of Complexity at the Santa Fe Institute and Professor of Computer Science at Portland State University in the U.S. Her current research focuses on conceptual abstraction and analogy making and visual recognition and artificial intelligence systems. Dr. Mitchell is the author or editor of six books and numerous scholarly papers in the fields of artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and complex systems. Her book, Complexity: A Guided Tour, won the 2010 Pi Beta Kappa Science Book Award and was named by Amazon.com as one of the 10 best science books of 2009. Her latest book is Artificial Intelligence: A Guide for Thinking Humans. So, Dr. Mitchell, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Okay, great. So I read your last book, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that I think you were trying to make there was to present the current state of AI, because there are people that say that AI is pretty close to getting at human-level intelligence. There are other people that say that we are very far from it. And what is your position there in that debate?
I think we're very far from human-level intelligence. So AI systems today can do a lot of really impressive things. They can play chess and go better than any human. They can transcribe our speech. They can recognize objects and images. They can recognize faces, as we all know. They can do all these things quite well most of the time. But they're not doing it in the same way that humans do it. And they are, because of that, they actually are not reliable. They can make strange, unhuman-like errors because, as I argue in the book, they don't really understand the data that they're working with in the same way that we humans do.
And that's interesting because there are things that for us are very hard to do, like for example, complex calculations that AI systems, they are able to do it in less than a second, let's say. But there are other things that for us are very easy, like some more commonsensical things that for AI systems, it's very hard for them to perform, at least at a human level, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Marvin Minsky, one of the pioneers of AI, famously said that AI has taught us that easy things are hard. So, exactly what you said, it's amazing that machines are able to do all these tasks that are extremely hard for humans, and yet they can't do the simplest things that like a human 2-year-old can do, like walk around a room without crashing into anything, being able to, go upstairs and do all kinds of very simple things that we humans take for granted, but that machines still have trouble with. So that's kind of the paradox of AI.
And what would be really human-level intelligence? Would that mean that a particular AI system would be able to behave and be cognitively similar to a human, or it would be different from a human, but in terms of intelligence would be at the same level? How would it be exactly?
That's a really good question, and I don't think that AI has a solid answer for that. It's been argued for ever since the beginning of the field, sort of what is it that we want to say is human-level intelligence and how can we measure it? So Alan Turing, of course, proposed his famous test, which is now called the Turing test, which is like, can a machine have a conversation with a human such that the human doesn't know that it's talking to a machine? That was the Turing test based on language. But it seems that that Turing test is a little bit too easy to pass for machines that aren't intelligent at all. We have chatbots that can mimic human conversation and fool humans fairly easily, and yet they're not intelligent in any way that we would like to define intelligence. So the question of how do we measure intelligence, really the fact that we don't know how to do it very well really shows that we don't understand our own intelligence very well, which is a big problem in trying to get machines to be intelligent.
Yeah. And since you mentioned the Turing test, is it really that reliable? Because I was just thinking that, okay, if an AI system is able to fool humans, exactly how and what humans and in what circumstances? I mean, I was just thinking about those kinds of things because, I mean, if we presented an AI system to a group of people and they were fooled the way they interacted with the system, they thought it was a human. I mean, is it really that relevant or not?
I think most people in AI don't feel like the Turing test is relevant or a good test anymore because it's too easy to fool people. I mean, perhaps if you constructed the test extremely carefully and had experts, computer scientists, AI experts as the judges, maybe it would be a little bit more useful, but it probably, at least for now, that it's not very useful, and machines can easily fool humans, and they do every day, you know, on Facebook, on Twitter, and so on. We have these bots that are pretending to be humans that are interacting with us, and we're fooled. Even the most expert people can be fooled by them.
Mm-hmm. Are deep learning algorithms the most prevailing ones nowadays in artificial intelligence, or are there others that are even more so or not?
So deep learning has really dominated the field for the last, you know, good part of a decade. It's been extremely successful on a lot of different applications. But people are, I think, beginning to see the limitations of deep learning. There's been quite a bit of discussion about how deep learning has, it relies on huge amounts of data to be trained. And often, even with that huge amount of data, it can make errors because it's not able to deal with situations it hasn't encountered before. You know, this is sort of what we see, for instance, in self-driving cars, which are the visual systems powered by deep learning. So there's been a lot of discussion about how to get AI systems to be more human-like in the way that they are able to reason about the world in a way that takes into account what you might call common sense, what you might call causality, that, you know, one thing causes another and we understand that. So there's been a lot of work, at least at the kind of the frontier of AI, is making computers less reliant on just huge amounts of data and more reliant on more innate common sense. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the next frontier of AI.
So it would have to have some built-in features, right?
For example, to have some either built-in features or to be able to learn kind of in the way that maybe babies learn, by interacting with the world and actively manipulating the world, things in the world, rather than just kind of passively being fed data the way that deep learning systems are. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, something that's been discussed. Alan Turing even said in his Turing test paper, maybe we should train, have AI systems learn the way children learn, mm-hmm. instead of trying to kind of, you know, train them to do things that only the most, you know, sort of high level adults can do, like Go and chess and so on. We should have them actually learn the way that a baby learns. So that's this idea of developmental learning in AI. It is a theme that's gone through the entire field for a long time, but now I think people are really seeing how important those early kind of what people call core knowledge acquisition, where we sort of just understand the world at its basic level in terms of objects and how objects interact with each other and gain the kind of common sense that babies have. So that's still a challenge for AI.
Yeah, and but doesn't that depend on the on what we want from AI systems? Because I was just thinking that, for example, if we want to use AI systems to understand a bit better how our own cognition works, maybe we would prefer them to be more human-like. But if we are only talking about the tasks that we want them to perform, like, for example, self-driving cars or playing Go or doing some complex calculations or whatever, perhaps they should be less human-like. Does this make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I think for certain tasks, we absolutely want them to be less human-like. We want them to do calculations perfectly and very quickly. If we want, you know, machines playing chess, they actually are very unhuman-like in the way that they can play chess, but they do much better than humans. But in tasks that are kind of in the real-world, open-ended tasks, like self-driving cars, these machines have to operate in our human world. They have to understand humans in a way that is not necessary for these other kinds of tasks. So here's an example. Evidently, the most common accident involving self-driving cars is that humans rear-end them, meaning they, you know, and what happens is that the self-driving cars slam on the brakes unexpectedly for no apparent reason, and the human's not expecting it, so the human crashes into them, right? So, and the reason is that the self-driving cars are perceiving things as obstacles, as things they should stop for that no human would stop for. Like maybe they see a bird flying or a leaf floating in the air. I don't know, but they are perceiving the world in a way that's very different than the way humans perceive it. And that makes them unreliable in dealing with humans when they're sort of in the same world that we are. So in that sense, we do need machines that can be more human-like, that can understand humans and reason about the human world. Mm-hmm. You know, for some tasks, we don't need that. For some tasks, I think we do.
Mm-hmm. And why is it the case that things like playing Go are easier for AI systems to perform? Is it because even though there are perhaps billions or even more combinations possible, I mean, the AI system is able to calculate them and to process them, but when it comes to things that humans are good at, I mean, it's more open-ended or something like that?
Yeah, I think it is, you know, chess or Go are very closed worlds in that there's only a certain set of possible moves to make. And even though there's a huge combinatorial set of possibilities, the machine, you know, we found ways to have the machines be able to efficiently search and evaluate different possibilities efficiently. So, but in the real world, it's so much more open-ended, and there's no rules in the way that there are in chess or Go. It's not so clearly defined how to train the system to deal with the real world. And that's the real problem. You know, in chess and Go, you can have the machines even just play the game with other machines, for example, over and over and over again, and they can learn. In the real world, it's hard to do that because it's just the lack of fixed rules and clear sort of states of the, you know, it's not like a game where you have very clearly defined states of the world. The world's just open-ended, and machines have trouble dealing with that.
So I asked you about deep learning, and I guess that one specific type of deep learning, if I'm not mistaken, has to do with neural networks. So are neural networks called that because they in some way resemble how neurons in our brain function and interact with each other or not?
They are inspired, I will say, by brain function. We have in a neural network, you have simulated neurons, which are extremely simple versions of actual neurons that are connected to other neurons, and those connections have different strengths, and the strengths change. But like any simplified model, it's lacking a lot of the complicated detail of the brain that might actually be very important. One big thing that today's neural networks largely lack is that they are completely feed forward, meaning that information starts at the input, travels through each of the layers of the neural network, and is processed until it produces an output. But in the human brain, in animal brains, there's all kinds of feedback, meaning that the higher layers, like our frontal cortex, feeds back to the lower layers, like our visual area. And that, in fact, I've been told there's, at least in the visual system, there's like 10 times more feedback connections than there are feed forward connections. But it's very hard to understand exactly what these feedback connections are doing. And it's hard to get them, for instance, to model them so that they work well in artificial neural networks. So this is just to say that these neural networks are inspired by the brain, but are extremely simplified versions of what they're trying to model.
And I mean, in terms of trying to build more human-like AI systems, is it necessary for us to have a complete understanding of how the cognitive mechanisms that operate in our brain function, or could it be a simpler version of that?
I don't know. That's a hard question. You would hope that you wouldn't have to know exactly everything about the brain. There's just some aspects of the brain that might not be necessary for, human level intelligence. So you wouldn't have to model them exactly, but no one really knows. So little is known about how the brain actually works. That's I think one of the problems with trying to model AI on the brain, because we have so little real understanding of how the brain works.
Yeah, that's the main reason why I asked you that question, because we are very far away from getting to a complete understanding of how our brain and our behavior works, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let me ask you a specific question. What is evolutionary computation?
So, similar to neural networks, evolutionary computation is inspired by biology. It's trying to use ideas from biological evolution in computer learning systems. So, in biological evolution, very roughly, Darwinian evolution, you have a population of individuals that are competing for resources, and they're also producing offspring, either by mating or sometimes just individuals produce, copy themselves. And then you have mutations, and this whole population dynamics produces individuals that are more fit to their environment. So in a computer, you'd like to simulate this by having a population, say, of programs. The programs are now competing with one another for doing the best job of whatever the task is that's set for them, and they're evolving. And eventually you get programs that are more able to do the task that you wanted them to do. So you, instead of writing the programs, you've actually evolved them. So evolutionary computation is a whole subfield of AI, I would say, that tries to take these evolutionary approaches.
And I've already alluded to this before, but to try to understand how our own cognition works, do you think that AI systems can be good models of that or not?
I think, yes, I think they can help us. We are trying to understand our own cognition, and one way to try and understand it is to model it, to try and build systems that we think have these properties, and to see where they succeed, to see where they fail, to see where they kind of match up with the data that we have on biological intelligence. So I do think that, and that's, one of the reasons I got into AI in the first place was I was interested in biological intelligence. And so I do think that it's possible to try and understand it better by modeling it. And it's more, you learn a lot from failure. You learn a lot from how your models don't succeed. And so sort of understanding sort of what are, how complex intelligence is, and how little we, even ourselves experiencing it, how little we know about our own intelligence.
And what do you think about about embodied cognition? Because there are people nowadays that say that perhaps some of the information that we get from the environment is encoded in how our body itself is structured, and the brain is not the end all and be all of cognition, let's say. What do you think about that?
I think it's absolutely right to say that the brain is not the only place where intelligence sort of is situated. Our bodies and our brains are intimately connected, of course, and our brains have been evolved to in synchrony with our bodies. So it's really hard to separate. AI has kind of progressed as a field by separating the brain or the intelligence from the body. Not everybody in AI, but most approaches, don't take the body into account. And I think that's makes them lacking in some ways of being able to mimic human intelligence, because so much of human intelligence is situated in our bodies, in sort of the interaction between our brains and our bodies. So I think a lot of people are really focusing on this to, and one example is the idea that we learn by actively manipulating things in the world with our bodies, with our hands, whatever, instead of being passively fed data. And so trying to get, for instance, robots to learn by actively manipulating things is a big push in AI, and maybe the only way we can really get more human-like AI.
So, apart from some innate aspects of our cognition that you think we should try to include in our AI systems to improve them, would you say that perhaps we should try to create AI systems that are more embodied and perhaps try to replicate our human body structured for them to acquire human level intelligence?
I think it's a really open question how much of our bodies we have to give to these systems, how much of the kind of bodies we have. Just like we talked about a couple minutes ago, do we have to replicate the brain exactly? I don't know. And do we have to replicate the body exactly? Probably not. But I think that there's some aspects of intelligence that are clearly embodied in the sense that they can't be easily separated from the kind of bodily structure we have. And we're still learning sort of what matters,
But probably some embodiment would be useful.
That's a hypothesis that, it seems really compelling to me, yes.
And what are complex systems?
Okay, so complex systems are systems that consist of many interacting components. You can think of the brain, for example, with all of its trillions of neurons that are interacting with other neurons. And the interactions make the system hard to kind of split up into pieces. Like you can't look at a single neuron and then add up all of the different neurons and get sort of be able to explain the brain. There's this notion that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, right? That's kind of the idiom, but it's actually very true. It's hard to just separate all the neurons and then add up their effects and understand the whole system. And that's true in complex systems in general. You have complex systems includes ideas like the collection of cells in your body, or the collection of, say, ants in an ant colony, or individuals in an economy. So all of these sort of broad array of systems in which you have these what we call nonlinear interactions of the components that gives rise to behavior that's hard to explain in terms of the sum of the parts. That's sort of what complex systems tries to study and make sense of. So that's it's a very broad field that's trying to make sense of these kinds of systems and look at their sort of what's common to all of them.
So it's sort of an emergentist approach to these systems, right? Because since the whole is more than the sum of its parts, I guess that would lead us to emergentism, right?
Right, so emergence is a term people sometimes use to describe the behavior, these sort of global behaviors that are hard to make sense of in just in terms of the parts. You know, if we could just understand a single neuron and then, you know, multiply that by a trillion and understand the brain, we would be in great shape. But the brain is more complex than that. So it's very, these systems are hard to understand. And so complex systems is trying to build tools, mathematical tools, computational tools that will help make sense of these very complex systems.
And so these complex systems, I mean, it's an interdisciplinary approach. It doesn't apply only to AI, right?
Correct. Correct. It's an interdisciplinary approach. It looks at systems in terms of different kinds of behaviors, like intelligence might be one kind of emergent behavior, or adaptation, or the dynamics, the complicated dynamics of the system. So part of the field of complex systems is trying to come up with these ways of making sense of these sort of what you would call emergent behaviors that we call, you know, intelligence or life, these other kinds of things that are hard to define.
So it also applies to biology, right? Since you mentioned life, it would also allow for us to better grasp perhaps where life comes from.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's, I think, a number of people in complex systems are looking at sort of origin of life, dynamics of living systems. At a very from a very broad interdisciplinary point of view.
And that would also allow us to better understand how do we get from inorganic molecules to organic molecules and life, because I mean, some of the time organic molecules at least have the same atoms and molecules as organic molecules, but then we have to understand how we make the transition, right?
Exactly. Right. So that's a little out of my expertise, but definitely something that people definitely study in complex systems.
Okay, so let me ask you about another thing that you study. Earlier, I asked you about evolutionary computation. What are genetic algorithms, and do they have something to do with genetics?
So genetic algorithms are one approach to evolutionary computation. They're again inspired, very roughly inspired by genetics, but are extremely simplified versions of it. So it's a, as I mentioned before, the idea that you have a population of individuals and the individuals are competing for resources and they're reproducing with mutations. That's genetic algorithms is one approach to that. So back in the 19 early 1960s, a lot of people, computing was just taking off. A lot of people were thinking about the relationship between computers and living systems, kind of like we are today. And a number of people kind of independently came up with these ideas about using ideas from evolution to build more lifelike computer systems. And genetic algorithms was developed by John Holland, who was at the University of Michigan, who was thinking about evolution. And other people developed other kinds of systems, sort of like genetic algorithms, but with some differences. And the whole thing is the umbrella term is evolutionary computation. So
Okay.
people use these terms sort of interchangeably.
Yeah, but it doesn't have anything to do with genetics, or does it to some extent?
No, it plays the same role as like neural networks do to brains. Genetic algorithms were inspired by, say, population genetics, how systems evolve using, systems of that are controlled by genes can evolve in a population. But it's an inspiration. It's like a simplified model. Now, that being said, genetic algorithms have been used in machine as a kind of machine learning technique, so that they actually can. Some people have, and this can get confusing in terminology, but people have used them to analyze gene sequences. And so, in that sense, they can have something to do with genetics.
Okay, let me ask you now about some particular aspects of your work. You do work on conceptual abstraction. So what is that about, and how does it work in AI systems?
So I'm interested in the idea of how people develop and use concepts. So I think it's best explained with an example. So, for example, think of the concept of a bridge, right? So you might think of the Golden Gate Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge or other famous bridges that span over water. But that concept of bridge is very rich in our sort of minds, so that we can say things like, well, I'm going to bridge my hands together, or I have the bridge of my nose, or we talk about the bridge of a song, or our current presidential candidate Joe Biden always says that he's the bridge to the next generation. And so we're using this term bridge in a very increasingly abstract sense. It's kind of a metaphor, but we don't even think of it as a metaphor. We just think of it as like, it's a bridge, right? We don't consciously even notice that we're using it metaphorically. So I've been interested for a long time in how we can get computers to have richer concepts that will allow them to make these kind of abstractions or understand these kind of abstractions. And that leads to analogy, where analogy is really a kind of abstraction where you're taking one situation and you're perceiving very abstract similarity to another situation. And that, this abstraction of bridge that I just mentioned, all of those are kind of analogies. Joe Biden is making an analogy when he says he's a bridge to a new generation. Because he's not literally a bridge, right? He's not like taking his body and spreading it out between two generations, but he's making an analogy. So this is the work that I did early on in my career for my PhD, was modeling how computers can make these kinds of analogies, which could be then used to do this kind of abstraction.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, what are the aspects of how people form concepts in their minds that are important for then to us to try to have the same in AI systems? Because I guess this is very, very complex and abstract, right?
Right. So for AI systems, you know, for deep learning systems, they can have sort of a concept, say, of a bridge, because they're given lots and lots of, say, photographs of bridges. And then I give them a new photograph, you know, they've been trained, and I give them a new photograph of a bridge, and they can say, yes, that's a bridge, right? Mm-hmm. It's more what psychologists call a perceptual category, mm-hmm. where you sort of can put a new input into a particular category. You know, I can say, this is a dog, this is a cat, this is a book, this is a bicycle, you know. But these systems are not able to do the kind of abstraction that we humans can do, like when I just mentioned. And no one really knows how that abstraction is done. There's a lot of theories in psychological literature about it, but it's still kind of controversial.
Mm-hmm. So even in humans, we don't understand it completely?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the most compelling theories say that we humans have these models, it's kind of simulations that we can run in our brains. Like when I talk about a bridge, I can imagine, for instance, myself walking across a bridge, mm-hmm. you know, maybe or driving across a bridge. And I sort of know the function of the bridge. I can imagine the bridge. I can predict things about what might happen if you drive across a bridge. And then I can take those kinds of simulations and I can abstract them to make sense of what it means for Joe Biden to be a bridge from one generation to another. But it's being done through a process of analogy. Mm-hmm. So my former PhD advisor, Doug Hofstadter, has written a lot of insightful things about analogy. And one of the things that he wrote was that he defined a concept as a package of analogies. And I think that's a great definition of a concept. Every concept we have, in a sense, is this kind of package of analogies. And so I would say that deep neural networks don't really have concepts in that way. They have perceptual categories, but they don't have concepts. And that's really what AI is lacking.
Mm-hmm. So perceptual categories, that's one of the things that they have to do, for example, tasks like face recognition, because they are able to pick up faces from all the other things in the particular picture, for example.
Exactly. They're able to separate faces. You know, I can say if I saw your face and then somebody else's face, the AI system could say, okay, well, this is Ricardo, this is somebody else, you know, I can separate them. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have, say, a concept of a face that you could abstract and talk about, you know, the face of a building or, you know, the face of a country or, you know, all these things that we use, this concept. So that's really the difference between a perceptual category and a concept, I think.
And do you have any idea as to how we will be able to arrive there? I mean, program AI systems that will be able to do some conceptual abstraction?
Well, so that's the research I'm engaged in now, and it's more like trying to get computers to make analogies. And there's a big sub-community of AI who work on analogy. There's a lot of different approaches. I have an approach that I've been working on for a while that really sees analogy as kind of a perceptual activity, except at more of a conceptual level, so that it's something that's happening sort of in your mind's eye, if you will, but it's involves quite a lot of feedback. We talked earlier about sort of feedback in the brain. So we have our perception works by having, you know, information comes in to our senses, but at the other hand, there's feedback from concepts that we already have that has a lot of impact on how we perceive something. So I'm working on systems that have those kinds of dynamics.
Yeah, and you've also done some work on visual recognition, right? We've already mentioned that a little bit, but what are some of the steps? I mean, if there are really steps that we can talk about that AI systems follow to be able to do some visual recognition or some object or other?
Right. So the typical, deep learning systems that we've talked about that you know go from input to output without any feedback, those basically learn to represent, say, a visual input in some way that they can then map it into a particular category. So for instance, if you think about like recognizing a dog, dogs have the visual representation of a dog. They have certain textures, they have certain shapes, they have, certain poses that they're likely to be in, they have certain size. And all of those features are used by these deep learning systems. The deep learning system, it's not programmed with any particular features in mind, but it learns, sort of pick out features that it can use to decide that this is a dog rather than a cat. Okay. But what's harder is to recognize what you might call visual situations. So multiple objects interacting. Like one of the ones that we looked at is someone walking a dog, where you have like a person that's holding a leash and the leash is attached to the dog and they're walking in the park or on the road or whatever. There, the perception gets much more complicated because there's so many different parts and they have different relationships to each other. So those are harder for that kind of deep learning system to learn. So in my work, we're integrating that kind of deep learning approach with models of concepts that we talked about before, so that the models of concepts can feed back to the features that are learned by the deep learning systems to try and make sense of a whole situation rather than an individual object.
And do the deep learning folks like this idea of perhaps including some built-in features, as we talked about before, and perhaps including some innate knowledge about what the AI system should expect to find in the world like we humans have?
That depends on the people. I mean, there's a big debate about what should be built in, sort of what's innate versus what's learned. This has been a debate for forever in AI, and it continues. So some people think that we should let the machines just learn everything from scratch, you know, to have sort of a blank slate of tabula rasa, where the system comes out with no prejudice, no bias towards any learning any particular thing, but it just like takes in the data. Turns out that's very difficult to get those things to work. That there, you have to build in some kind of prior structure. And everybody agrees that you have to build in some kind of prior structure, pretty much. But now there's a debate about how much structure should be built in. People look at, like, you know, human development, how much do babies know innately versus how much do they learn? And that's still a matter of debate. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the big debates that are going on in the AI community.
Mm-hmm. But just by trying to build these AI systems, we already learned something about how our own cognition works, because if they have these difficulties performing these tasks that we do easily, then, I mean, we already learn from that, that probably people that say that we have that core knowledge, let's say, are at least to some extent correct.
I think so, yeah. But then there's always the question, well, maybe the AI system didn't have enough data, or maybe it didn't have enough layers in its deep learning system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but then, I mean, if it's a question of data, then by simply feeding the system with more data, I mean, would that really solve the problem? Because I guess that, for example, in the case of humans, okay, we are able to learn certain things, but we don't pick all of the information that is out there. We are focused to picking up information for certain specific things in our environment.
Exactly. So I personally don't think more data is the answer. But there are people who argue that even like what you just said, where we pay attention to certain things, they believe that that's something that we've learned rather than something that's like innate in our brains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm not sure. I'm just thinking here, but if it was a matter of data, for example, we have some animals that were domesticated by us, for example, if it was a matter of data, why is it the case that by hearing me talking, a baby is able to learn a language and a dog is not? So, I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. Yeah, it's not just data, obviously, it's the structure of the brain and the body, too.
Yeah.
You have vocal cords, which a dog doesn't have, you know, very different ones. But yeah, so these are all, like, as you can imagine, there's lots of nuances in these debates, and it's not just cut and dried that, you know, here's a list of things that are innate to us and not to dogs. I think it's just, you know, it's still a very open question. What is our core knowledge? What is it that we come with when we're born?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in AI, there's also that debate about us having to be careful about the types of AI systems that we develop, because they might turn against us. But and that's another interesting thing, I guess, because, as we've already talked about here, we are very far from getting to a human-like or human-level AI systems, but we don't need that for us to have algorithms that already have some impact on our lives.
Yeah, so algorithms have huge impact on our lives, and people have shown that algorithms can have biases, mm-hmm. that, for instance, speech recognition and face recognition algorithms tend to work better on lighter skinned people. Mm-hmm. They tend to work better on males than females. And so these can have actual impacts on our lives, that, you know, on our civil rights, on our sort of success in the world. Because algorithms are so they're so embedded in our society now. So this is a big danger. A lot of people are now thinking about what they call fairness and transparency in algorithms. And the fairness part is, how do we get algorithms that don't have the kind of biases that will hurt certain classes of people? And transparency is, how do you get algorithms to explain their decisions? so that we know what they base their decisions on. Like if some algorithm decides that you shouldn't get a credit card because, well, who knows, it decided that, you know, having these algorithms be transparent about their decisions is extremely important. But as the AI systems get more and more complex, it's harder and harder to get them to be transparent.
Yeah, so, I was just thinking about that, because I mean, the kinds of complex computations that they are doing, would it be possible for them to explain to us how they did that in a way that would be intelligible for us?
That's a very big challenge now. And you know, even the people who created these algorithms, who trained them, don't understand fully why they make the decisions they make. And that's a danger. So the whole idea of transparency or explainability is really important. But then you get to the question of, well, what is an explanation? What does that even mean? Like, what does the explanation have to include? So this is getting, you know, regulatory and legal systems that are trying to deal with AI and algorithms are having to grapple with this. Mm-hmm. So if like, you know, there's a law that says, well, algorithm has to be able to explain itself as to why it made this decision, well, then that law has to say, what is an explanation? It's not an explanation to say, well, it used this set of a billion weights. That's not an explanation that a human could understand. But what is a sort of legally required explanation? So all these thorny questions are starting to come up in trying to sort of regulate or build laws around these AI systems.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that some AI systems present biases in the way they function, because we would imagine, at least before we develop them, that probably because they just simply look at the data and they learn how to process it, that they wouldn't have any sort of bias. I mean, when we think about AI systems, we usually associate some rationality to them. I think we think that they would be more rational than we are.
Well, that's not always the case. I mean, we train them with data, mm-hmm. and that data has certain inherent biases. For instance, a lot of the facial recognition systems have been trained using faces that have been posted on the web, for example. And those people who post their pictures on the web statistically tend to be more light-skinned, more male, might have other characteristics. And even the kinds of very subtle image processing procedures that are done to these images might introduce bias. Mm-hmm. So for instance, you know, I even recently read an article that said that cameras they tend to be better at picking up lighter skinned faces than darker skinned faces. And so, you know, the biases are built in all the way up from the cameras up through the data selection and so on. So there's all these subtle biases that are in the data, and the systems, the AI systems learn statistics of the data. That's what they learn. And so those biases get translated into the hard to understand processing of these AI systems.
Mm-hmm. But is that because of the data or because of the way they learn and how they are programmed to process the data? Because I would imagine that that bias that has to do with they being able to identify much better light-skinned people than dark-skinned people would have something to do with the fact that maybe in those data they have much more, for example, light-skinned faces than dark-skinned ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's one problem. And it may also be that the light-skinned faces just have, the photographs have features that make them easier to learn from. It can be very subtle. And also the fact that people sort of building these systems don't even notice the biases has to do with like the fact that the group of people that are sort of building the AI systems are not very diverse themselves. They're mostly white males. So there's a whole kind of sociological aspect to it. I mean, one less kind of racially charged example is like self-driving cars. You know, if you have most self-driving cars being tested in places like California or Arizona or very sunny, warm places, it may be that those cars won't work as well in places that are much colder or cloudier or rainier.
Yeah.
If everybody who's working on those systems lives in California, you know, this is an oversimplification, they might not, that might not be something that they necessarily build into the systems.
It's
a problem.
Yeah, what I was trying to ask you was if you think that by simply providing them with more diverse data, it would solve the problem, or if for some reason the way they process the data would always lead them to those kinds of biases for some reason.
I don't think it's just, I mean, more diverse data obviously is important, but I think what I was trying to say is that there's more, there's even more subtle aspects to this that, you know, we might not even be aware of. And so more diverse data doesn't always necessarily solve the problem.
So, and how should we approach it then? If it's not about the data, is it about they are programmed to process the data, or?
I think people are still trying to figure this out, you know. And it kind of shows that this like diversity of perspective is needed not just like in the data but also in the people who actually curate the data or train the systems or build in the image processing systems, that if you lack diversity at in some aspect of this whole process, you can get biases that, very subtle biases that can occur.
And when we think about AI systems turning against us, we usually associate them, or we think about things like the Terminator and AI systems that are very, very complex and human-like, but we don't need that in order for some problems to be caused by them in human societies.
Exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of people have pointed out that the problem isn't that the machines are too smart, it's that they're too stupid. They're not smart enough. And that but we trust them too much. That's the problem we're facing.
So you don't trust AI systems to make decisions for us, or at least decisions that really matter for our lives?
I think we have to be very, very careful. You know, humans are not that great at making decisions either. And, you know, there's a lot of arguments, for instance, for like self-driving cars, that humans are terrible drivers. They don't pay attention. They get bored. They fall asleep. They text, you know, whatever. And they get into crashes all the time. And so why not use self-driving cars, which also make mistakes, but different kinds of mistakes. But, you know, you just have to be very careful and figure out sort of, do you want to grant autonomy to systems that are untrustworthy in ways that that are hard for us to predict and understand? And that's one of the problems with these AI systems, is that they're untrustworthy as humans are in making decisions, but we really don't understand them maybe as well as we understand like human decision making. So it's kind of a hard trade-off. So you have to, you know, I think people just have to really start understanding the limitations better of these AI systems. I think of ultimately, you know, you're not gonna, there's some areas in which it would be okay to let these systems be autonomous, and there's some in which you'd really like to have humans in the loop. And understanding how to decide it's still a big problem in AI. It's still, because we don't understand these systems very well.
Yes, I was just thinking again about programming common sense in AI systems, and couldn't it be the case that if we do that, if we program them with some innate aspects, with core knowledge, for example, as we talked about before, that they would be also prone to those to the biases that humans have.
Yeah, it's very possible that, you know, we humans have lots of cognitive biases, and it's possible that we won't be, if we start programming machines to be more human-like, have more human-like common sense, that they'll have those biases as well. So I think it's an open question whether you can build a machine that has kind of the best parts of humans, but not the worst parts. I don't know. It would be great if you could, but I'm not sure that's possible.
Okay, so Dr. Mitchell, let's end on that note. But just before we go, would you like to mention what are some of the best places on the internet for people to find your work?
So they can go to my website, which is melaniemitchell.me. And I think everything that I've ever done is on there, pretty much. So that's probably the best place. The other thing I could mention, if people are interested in complex systems, we have an online educational platform called complexityexplorer.org. It's also linked from my webpage that has lots of free online classes about all aspects of complex systems.
Okay, great. So I will include that in the description box of the interview down below so that people can go and check it out. Your work is very interesting, by the way, and I really loved your latest book. And again, Dr. Mitchell, thank you for taking the time to come on the show. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Hello everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel back in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. And I also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and main supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Peruga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klingby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nacio, Arthur Coe, Marco Neves, Max Belby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugney, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Felicia Stevens, Fergal Cusson, Yevon Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Labrant, Oslem Bullet, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, Sardus France, David Sloan Wilson, and Yasila Deza Araújo. My producers, Izar Weber, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Dr. Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Agdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, and my executive producers, Michel Rogieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.